In the palm reader story, you mentioned that Ajahn Chah still had a lot of anger, but that he chose not to act from it. So does this mean that, for example, if there was a troublesome monk, Ajahn Chah would still experience a flare of anger, but have the wisdom to set it aside and consider what to do with a cool head? This sounds similar to what Ramdas has said about his defilements. After so many years of practice, they're still there, but now more like little neurotic schmooze that he can relate to in a relaxed way. My understanding of how Ajahn Chah, what the palm reader is looking at is like fundamental temperament or tendencies, karmic tendencies because that's what a good palm reader or astrologer is. These are the patterns that are there, and so that anger was a particular tendency that Ajahn Chah manifested, but also through his ability to understand and see clearly, relinquishing the tendency, then the awareness is, there's such clarity that, you know, the mind is not drawn to it at all. So that there's a very interesting circumstance that one of the Western monks had with Ajahn Chah. Ajahn Jayasaro, who's an English monk, and he was attending to Ajahn Chah and sitting and massaging his feet, and there was other monks around, and then a particular monk came in who had he had done something wrong. He'd been admonished for it. He was undergoing a period of penance. And Ajahn Chah just sort of barked at him and sort of scolded him. And there's this sort of, you know, it's like, one would think, like a flare-up of anger. That's was manifested. That was what was seen. Ajahn Jayasaro, who was sitting there massaging him, said, "The curious thing was that there was absolutely no tension in his body. There was no feeling of anything, of a mood. There was no mood coming through the no manifesting of a mood, any kind of excitement, any kind of, there was just." Ajahn Chah said, "Well, I think what this monk needs is to be ripped up one side and down the other." doing it with kind. There's a similar circumstance that I had one time with Ajahn Mahabua, who is he's well known. One, I mean, he's well known for a couple of things. One, he's considered sort of the Arahant of the age in Thailand. He's in his mid-90s now, considered to be highly attained for a long time now. And and he's also well known for his ferocious tendencies. Remember one time going and visiting him, spending some time with him, and And I'd been, it was in a period I'd done a lot of practice at that time. The mind was very, very still and very clear. And then watching Ajahn Mahabua speaking, you know, in a ferocious way, and seeing the kind of action, hearing the words, but the feeling that I was flooded with these feelings of joy and loving kindness that he was actually emanating. So it's a bit different than while you're able to sort of control the anger or not get caught, you know, but it's different when it's really not there, on a deep level. So that's and certainly Ajahn Chah, if he you never quite knew. You never quite knew. You were always very careful around him, because you never knew which side was going to come out. And it wasn't as if he was just playing with you, but it was like he always responded to the situation or the person, and there was no fixed way he was going to be boxed in and respond to. Say, oh, I'm supposed to be a nice, loving kindness monk. Well, I guess I better not do that. But, you wouldn't want to get it in the way sometimes. So it's just because he could be very direct, you know, very, very blunt. Okay. Would you explain the duties adult children have towards aging parents and the duties of parents towards their children, as taught by the Buddha? Certainly the Buddha taught that one look after one's parents, try to care for their needs, that's seen in Asia in general, that's very much a part of the cultural norm, that one looks after one's parents, and then of course the parents have a duty toward their children of both helping and being role models for their children and grandchildren. That's sort of in an ideal world, that's how it works. the Buddha also said that the greatest gift that one can give to one's parents is to, and I think it probably work the same way with parents towards children, is that encouraging one's parents in virtue, in generosity, and in right view. And so those are seen as much material sort of caring that one can give to one's parents, and that's a excellent, necessary thing to be doing. But something that is even more beneficial, useful, is if one has the opportunity to encourage one's parents in establishing themselves in a higher degree of virtue and a higher degree of generosity, and trying to encourage them in aspects of right view, understanding, discernment. Okay. In a Dhamma talk several years ago, you mentioned an interview of a Christian monk. Reflecting on his 40 years of monastic life, the monk said something like, "I wish I had been more kind." Reflecting on your 35 years in robes, do you have any strong lessons that stand out? I'm not interested in regrets, but rather the kinds of wisdom, knowledge, that the accumulation of years of practice illuminates. Well, it would depend on whatever sort of the thought of the moment as it comes out. Certainly it's also very encouraging that people actually remember Dhamma talks. I've forgotten that. if reflecting on 35 years in robes, I think a strong lesson that sort of pops out, just picking out of the random out of the hat right now, something. I think the aspect of just patience. It's certainly something that Ajahn Chah emphasized over and over again, and for myself, I think that same. Sort of lesson is one that comes to mind right now, and just the importance of just being willing to be patient with things, and that recognition of, because oftentimes we don't recognize the goodness that we're doing and that we're engaged in. Oftentimes our standards are high, and our expectations are high, and we judge ourselves in ways that are reflect that expectation and standard, so that we're not patient enough to sort of recognize the goodness that we're actually doing, or and I think it's really important to have the patience to be able to watch and be present with that fundamental goodness that is a motivating factor in all of the things that we do. And anybody who's on a retreat here, you wouldn't be here if you weren't committed to leading a really skillful, wholesome, good life. That's oftentimes not reflected on. I've got to do this, I've got to do that, I've got to live up to this standard. And this teacher said this, that teacher said that, that person. It goes on and on, and And then we always feel like we come up short somehow. And that to be able to be patient enough to just set all that aside and say, well, you know, what's really important to me? And to really allow that to come into the heart and recognize it. And again, it's that sense of patience isn't just sort of enduring, but it's like being able to be present with experience. And I think that's more how I relate to patience, is that willingness, that ability to just be really present with experience, and so that we can take it in and be present for it. Next question is: Is it hopeless to send loving kindness to Mara? Well, Mara gets a bad rap. it depends how one relates to it, in the sense of Mara is always, it's the personification of the sort of the tempter, so that sort of in the midst of being tempted with the say the desire of the moment, and then loving kindness might not be the right tool. But in a bigger sense, when we think of the personification of the tempter, personification of evil, that is probably the most important thing to be have loving kindness towards, in the sense that again, it's that loving kindness that is the wish for well-being. And I think that even Mara, who is the sort of the epitome of the tempter, the personification of evil, that's a lot of suffering, isn't it? sort of the karmic accumulations don't bode well, and so that sense, when one recognizes the tendency within oneself, that when we follow our desire, get caught in our views and opinions, how we suffer, then the whole construct of how that keeps repeating itself, which is, let's say, the forces of Mara, that's a worthy object of loving kindness, because there's so much suffering there. Being able to turn one's attention to what is the way out of suffering. Okay. When you guided meditation in the past two afternoons, I've enjoyed slipping past the high energy of rapture / joy. I found these meditations incredibly grounding and at the same time streaming with energy. I'm finding it difficult to get past joy without your vocal guidance. Can you offer suggestions? Well, I think one is that is a memory, in the sense that you've had, and it's experiential memory. So they say, okay, that's possible to go past that sort of, say, that excitement of rapture and joy and be grounded in something that's very stilling, but still clear and spacious, so that I think the tuning into the body, because the body remembers these things, and we can, because if we try to think our way, okay, now how did that happen? So that I went past, got past rapture and joy, and got to no, it's sort of, but coming into the body the body remembers, and to be able to allow the rhythm of the breath, the sort of the feeling, perceptions that attend that feel, those feelings of joy, but still, yeah, that steadiness and clarity. Trying to connect with it on a bodily level, on a physical level. That's what I would suggest. Because I think one of the tendency for energy, rapture and that joy is, I mean, it's an energy. There can be that level of excitement that comes up. It sort of bubbles up. That's neat. That's sort of when you give an image of what joy does. It bubbles up. Moving the energy down and through the body, allowing it to settle. I think that's a skillful way to work with that joint, not letting it go up into, because once it comes up, then it goes into the proliferating mind, the thinking mind. What are the characteristics of our personalities? Our personalities conditioned by karma and our family, culture, nationality? And how do I learn to not take mine as truth and real? It's the suffering that is how we learn to drop it. You know, one recognizes the limitation, the drawback, sort of the pain that's involved, and certainly the personalities are conditioned by all of that, past karma, present karma, family karma, cultural karma. Nationality, gender, everything. I mean, it's all a part of the conditioning process. But it's recognition that of its impermanence, instability, changing nature, because what we call our personality, sometimes it manifests like this, sometimes it manifests like that, depending on the people we're with, the circumstances we're with. It isn't as if it's fixed and immutable. It just is. It picks and chooses, so that it's like learning how to recognize that. And saying, okay, well, that what I take as mine and as me is really not fixed at all. And by seeing that impermanent, changing, uncertain nature, that was when Ajahn Chah would translate the word anicca is usually translated as impermanent or changing, but Ajahn Chah would tend to translate it as uncertain or not sure, and I think that's really an important shift in the sense that when we think of, oh, that's impermanent, oh, that's changing, then it tends to be objectified. Whereas when we think of uncertain, well, then that's much more subjectified. It's more how I feel, how I experience it. So it's an important shift to sort of bring it back into the subjective field of how do I experience what I think of as moods, feelings, impressions, thoughts, personality. So that one is the sort of seeing the suffering involved that inevitably comes up with that, those perceptions, the burden I was talking about this morning, the limitation of sort of being like being a dog tied to a post, but also it's really important that we don't take it too seriously, that we're actually able to laugh at ourselves, laugh at the human condition. Because it's that, say that taking it all very seriously is sort of weighs one down. But in the end, it is, it's just, it's this absurd. Our life is so often like some, how did I walk into this Samuel Beckett play? they did it again. Just to clarify for my loving kindness anxiety, any phrases are okay? They can be said as a chant or any speed? Is one more effective for attaining deep concentration? The phrases have to have some sort of a feeling of meaningful to one. I mean, isn't, and again, it's sort of more around, is it meaningful to you? Does it resonate somehow? Does it, because as I've said, as the what is really important is not so much the phrases or sort of the methodology, but the feeling that arises, the feeling that is generated, that is established within the heart of loving kindness, so that they can be, you can just slowly. And I think also as you cultivate loving kindness as a practice, as a meditation, inevitably it's helpful to have, you know, having a few different phrases, chants, techniques, methods that make sense to one, feel comfortable to one, because the nature of the mind is to get inured to whatever you're going to do. However good it is, you're going to get familiarized. It's going to lose its potency, and whether it's quickly or slowly, it's the nature of the mind. So that to have a few tools. And it's like if you have a tradesman show up at your house, and you want them to, electrician to fix something, and you know, he walks in, no tools, just one screwdriver, and you say, I don't know, I don't have much. One's not going to gain confidence, then the job's going to get done. So it's the same as we're cultivating and practicing, as having some tools on your belt. It's just useful. There's a second question. Sometimes when I am concentrated, I have spontaneous body and or facial movements. They may be gross, that is, large, not yucky, or just small twitches. Can you comment on this? This is it's reasonably common, again, this is where an attunement to the body is quite helpful. And loving kindness actually is very good for balancing that kind of energy within the sort of the body mind complex, and allowing that to unravel or untie. Trying to concentrate too strongly, or forcing the mind, or forcing the mindfulness, that tends to exacerbate. So that a mindfulness practice that is sort of broad-based and body-based is very helpful for letting that kind of energy flow through the body-mind. And then loving kindness has a kind of a subsidiary effect of softening, relaxing, settling. So those are just good practices to work with. Is gladness the same as thankfulness? In the chant, where it's translated as gladness, actually there's a couple places where gladness is sometimes used. And this is a problem with translations, and there are different translations are used for different words, and it can be confusing sometimes. But generally, the what's translated as gladness is, say, in the Brahma Viharas, one of the translations they use is for gladness is from mudita, which is more like appreciative joy, sympathetic joy, delighting in the goodness, success of others. So that's not quite the same as thankfulness. Another word that is sometimes translated as gladness comes in that there's I can't remember when I read it out. I think it was this morning with the suttas were, it might have been yesterday. But it was from a reading where there's through the recollection of Dhamma, then there's a gladness arises, and then because of the gladness, then there's a joy arises. With joy, then there's tranquility. Tranquility, happiness. Happiness, concentration. But that quality, of gladness is from the Pali, which is pamoja, and that's like a feeling of well-being, a kind of delight, sense of feeling good about something that can arise. Oftentimes, the causal conditions in those sequences are a bit different. It's reflecting on virtue and the sense of non-remorse. Then there's a feeling of gladness arising. Reflecting on Dhamma, reflecting on the teachings, the kind of the truth of the teachings, then a gladness arises, a sort of gladness, satisfaction. Oh, wow, this is really true. Having faith or confidence arising. So there's that pamoja. Whereas thankfulness is more like, I say, one of the words that is, a gratitude, which is in Pali is like katanyu, and that feeling of thankfulness, appreciation, gratitude. So there's a different quality to it. So that that word gladness is used in a couple different ways. So second part of the question. By the way, what does pasano mean? And it means its primary meaning is one having faith, but as a sort of as also one having faith, one having joy, sort of a joyful faith. So, and after all these years, whoever wrote this, they spelt my name right, and everybody pronounces, and even myself as well, pronounce it as pasano, but it's actually pasano. But it started when very early, when a young monk at Wat Nanachat at the International Monastery in Thailand. Everybody thought it was like, sound like some sort of Italian peasant. So I said, it's always been pasano. Can I give a big metta hug to the cute little Ajahn? No. The near enemy of equanimity is aloofness. I've tasted both. One is much more familiar, and the difference is quite apparent. Can you offer any clues to identify subtle aloofness, which may not be so obvious, especially to the habituated mind? I think one of the qualities that one of the things that immediately comes up, because I've mentioned it several times, and then it also came up in the reading of the Kalama Sutta, of the where the Buddha immediately asks, is this wholesome or unwholesome? Is it beneficial or not beneficial? So that there's that immediate turning to that quality of and tuning into, well, what is kusala and what is akusala? So that the say the near enemy of equanimity is aloofness or indifference, and indifference will always have there'll be a certain negativity or dullness or a slight sort of aversion there. It's just sort of I don't want to deal with this. I don't want to know about it. Get out of my face. No. And I can be okay with you. but that's that. Whereas equanimity, say like as a Brahma Vihara, will be kusala. It will be wholesome. It will be associated with a sense of well-being, a sense of clarity, a presence there's equanimity in the sense of being balanced, but it's also there isn't a shutting out or a holding at bay. This doesn't need to be. When there's that equanimity, one can be completely present with whatever's there, because it isn't intimidating. It isn't something that is fearful. It's not even strange. It's just, this is the way it is. Oh, okay. So there's one can hold it in a very wholesome space. Because it's not intimidating, it's not fearful, it's not it doesn't stir up any kind of aversion or negativity. It's just, oh, that's the way it is. Okay. So there's a clarity there. So this that tuning into kusala and akusala, it really sorts things out really, really quickly. In your opinion, why do you think Venerable Moggallana is most often portrayed in the suttas as a bit of an idiot / highly impractical, while Venerable Sariputta is portrayed as wise and skillful? Both were the Buddha's leading disciples. Is this possibly a result of translator's view, or is it so in Pali also? Actually, Moggallana, I think, if anybody gets a bit of the short end of the stick, it's sometimes Ananda, because he's a bit of a fall guy sometimes. Moggallana is oftentimes very well. One is with all his psychic powers, and he's there's a certain spectacular quality. And he's also sometimes involved in sorting out problems within the Sangha. So he's both trusted as well as proactive in dealing with Sangha matters. There is sometimes, I'm not so sure, I'm not so familiar with like Mahayana suttas. Certainly Sariputta often is in Mahayana suttas is oftentimes portrayed as he's certainly the fall guy sometimes. I'm not sure how Moggallana comes across in Mahayana suttas. But I think Moggallana, I also say like Aniruddha there's a passing comment one time where Ananda has asked Aniruddha to sort something out and it didn't get done. And the Buddha sort of said, why did you even ask Aniruddha? You know what he's like. he's not interested in that kind of thing. I mean, he's just not interested in practical matters. I mean, it wasn't a criticism. It was just sort of, it was the wrong person for the job. I think one of the things is in the Pali canon, these people, these sort of great disciples, really come across as human to me. They have personalities. They have they're distinct individuals, and they're. There's a great sutta where Sariputta's sitting and meditating in the forest, and Moggallana sort of see Moggallana, who's adept in psychic powers, sees this scene unfolding where these two yakas, which are sort of like demons, they're non-human beings, and they're sort of walking along, going past. They see Sariputta sitting meditating in the forest. It's day before the full moon day, nicely shaved heads. And one of the yuccas says, look at that nicely shaved head. Wow, I'd just love to take my club and wallop him over the head. And the other yucca sort of says, I wouldn't do that if I were you. these sons of the Sakyans, they're pretty special sometimes. Be careful. I don't know. God, look at that. That's a great target. I don't think I can resist. Or he goes on. Takes his club and wallops him over the head. And the description is, gives him a blow that could have sort of split a mountain, and Sariputta is sort of unmoved, and Moggallana has sort of seen this scene unfold, and Sariputta comes out of his meditation And Moggallana says, "How are you feeling today?" He says, "Okay, got a bit of a headache today." He says, "Well, it's no wonder you know, it's no wonder you have a bit of a headache. You know what just happened to you?" There's these yakas, and he tells them the scene, and says, "You know, this is amazing, this is wonderful, this yaka is able to give this mighty blow to Sariputta," and all he says is, "I'm okay, I've got a bit of a headache though." And then Sariputta says, "That's not amazing. What's really amazing to me is that you can see these things happening." He says, "I've never seen," yeah, the way he puts it, "I've never seen so much as a mud sprite, let alone a yak or a dave or anything like that." That was that. And then the sutta sort of ends, and this is how it was, these great disciples sort of admiring each other's qualities. What are the primary distinctions between Theravada, Mahayana, and Vajrayana? So, well, without confusing people, you know, I think Theravada. Just by the very literal translation of its name, means the teaching of the elders, so that its sort of primary focus and purpose has been to try to maintain the tradition as it was passed down as closely as they could to what they assumed was the original teachings of the Buddha. I mean, there's always some accretions and additions and whatnot, but that's been its sort of primary kind of flavor, and it's also, say, interesting that when His Holiness the Dalai Lama gives teachings, then one of the things he will do is invite Theravada, Mahayana, Vajrayanas to give a blessing before the teachings begin, and he'll always invite the Theravadins to do a Pali chant first, because he said the Pali are the sort of the oldest scriptures, and these are the sort of the elder brothers of within the Buddhist fold, and then he gives deference. It's very beautiful, the Mahayana, as in Buddhist history, then there was a range of about 250 years. By about 250 years after the Buddha, there were about this time of King Asoka, there's about 18 different distinct schools of Buddhism. And it was subsequent to that that there began to be a Mahayana movement, which was a kind of reinvigorating and redefining some of the principles, of which one of the main ones that is distinctive is the putting the emphasis on the bodhisattva practice. And then the Vajrayana is a later school as well. From that, grew out of the Mahayana. Although the Vajrayana with, because there's several Vajrayana schools. Usually when you say Vajrayana, you usually think of Tibetan. But there's many Vajrayana schools. But certainly the Vajrayana schools within Tibet, they actually took many of the different schools and brought them to Tibet. And one of the distinctive qualities of the Vajrayana is the emphasis on faith and ceremony, ritual, efficacy of that, using of it. And that's these are just snapshots. But the sort of elaborate ritual ceremony, and then the and of course within that there's a huge number of schools as well. All of these, when you look at Buddhism, there isn't a Theravada tradition, Mahayana tradition, Vajrayana tradition that is homogeneous and monolithic. Even within a country like Thailand that's considered, say, very strictly Theravada, you start digging into the history and how both the doctrinal as well as popular Buddhism, and look at that! It looks like a Mahayana teaching. Oh, that looks like that looks like a tantric ritual. What? Wow, be darned! It is. And so that there has been mixing and sort of cross pollination been going on for millennia. So. How many people are currently on the Abhayagiri monastic waiting list? How long is the average wait time? What do they do usually? Or what do they usually do while they wait? Uh-huh. I'm not sure actually how many are on the waiting list right now. There's one or two that are perpetually on the waiting list. And it really depends on how the average weight, say like Louis came right at a good time and just slipped right in. It really is. I can't really give a clear answer to that. Different years are different. Like last year, there was people were waiting for quite some time. Sometimes there's been people waiting for a year, 2 years, and oftentimes, if it looks like there's going to be a long wait, maybe go to England or to Thailand, which is what happened to Sampajana. Came as a layman, was looking like going to be a long wait. It was going to be a long wait. And So I thought, okay, well, I go to England and I train there, become an Agarika or a novice, then come back to Ubayagiri, which is what he did. Okay, last question. Ooh. What could American culture learn from Thai culture? Well, in terms of one of the what sort of immediately comes to mind is the one of the first things you learn if you go to Thailand, and there's a phrase, it says, Mai Pan Lai. That's just, that would be a really good thing for American culture to learn. Mai Pan Lai. Mai Pan Lai means never mind.
Like
Boy Wong. Yeah, sort of like, Boy Wong, let go, it's not a big deal. Oh, never mind, it's okay, it's no big deal. Mai Pan Lai. It's one of the predominant sort of kind of cultural panaceas. it allows people to navigate some of the thorny aspects of human relationship. Mai Pan Lai. Yeah, okay. That's just the way it is. Oh, never mind. There's no point in getting upset. Mai Pan Lai. There are many, many things. Of course, Thailand is steeped in Buddhist culture for a long, long time. There's a book that was written by Prabhu Yuto. I don't think it's ever been translated into English. But both, because he had spent a few years in America as a visiting scholar to Harvard and to somewhere else, another university. And his English is very good. And one of the things, the book he wrote was Thailand viewing America, America viewing Thailand, sort of the exchange or interchange, the things that each could learn. So that he was. Just seeing that there's the possibilities. And that's one of the things that, say, for myself, having grown up in Western North American culture, and then having lived in Thailand for 23 years, in a rural environment that there was not English speaking happening, so that being able to be steeped in a completely different culture. And it was very helpful in being able to step back from cultural conditioning. As well as sort of saying, well, it isn't as if there's a perfect culture anywhere. And it's just, the human condition is just not that way. So and you think, wow, boy, if there was a culture that was steeped in Buddhism, then that would really solve all the problems of the world. No, it wouldn't. There's still human beings there. create suffering wherever they go. Okay. Perhaps we can have a really quick break and come back for evening puja. Truncated, I think.